This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we've got author Anthony Arnov, author of the book Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal, speaking about how to get out of Iraq.
The title comes from a book by Howard Zinn, The Logic of Withdrawal, about Vietnam. And sadly, it's deja vu again. We now have to get ourselves out of Iraq.
During the American war against the Vietnamese, who more than the American soldiers over in Vietnam knew the truth about the war? Their anti-war actions, bolstered by the peace movement here in the United States, was a big factor in getting out of Vietnam. We have today Jonathan Hutto, who's organizing in the Navy about getting out of Iraq.
I hope someday we'll be able to make a film, Yes Sir, No Sir, about how U.S. troops basically helped us end the war in Iraq.
Today we're speaking with Jonathan Heifetz about the awful story about an American citizen sentenced to death in Iraq.
We speak with his lawyer and his last desperate attempts to save Mohammed Mounaf's life. Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, Director of the USA Program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Since the summer of 2004, Law and Disorder has brought Pacifica listeners the voices of activists, authors, and attorneys from the front lines. There's been a sea change in the laws, policies, and practices of this government since the attack of 9/11.
Today's show is a special show about the war in Iraq. It's actually the fourth part of a series in which we have tried to give the listeners a sense of the profound changes that have happened in this country, particularly around human rights, civil liberties, and law since 9/11. The first show, we laid out the blueprint for the police state and talked about significant legislative efforts, significant presidential orders that really gave the president this incredible power so that you could actually impose a police state when and if the president wants. The second show was around U.S. detention policy, particularly Guantanamo, Bagram, detention disappearances, torture, rendition, a policy and a practice, of course, that is still going on. The third show was on criminalization of dissent. What happens to people in protests, the misuse of criminal law to go after Muslims, that whole series of events that we've seen unfold going against particularly protesters, Muslims, and others. And as I said, this fourth show is about the war in Iraq, and of course it has a direct relationship to 9/11, because first of all, 9/11 was used as an excuse in part to go after Iraq, saying that Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11, obviously completely false. And the second is an issue we've talked about on the show a fair amount, which is this government treated the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon as if they were acts of war rather than criminal acts. Once they called them acts of war, they decided basically they could make war on the world through those acts. By doing so, they applied a sort of a law of war situation to this in which they believed that they could simply wipe out and eliminate fundamental human rights for people. So the war in Iraq, apart from the complete lies we were told, is directly related to 9/11 and directly related to suppression of liberty in this country and abroad.
And I recall how eloquently you stated it right after 9/11. when it looked like they were building up to the war in Iraq. And I remember you were saying, you can't have democracy at home and an empire abroad. And that's certainly been shown to us over the last 3 years.
We're real happy to have Anthony Arnov on Law and Disorder. Anthony's written 3 books on Iraq. The latest is called Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal, put out by the New Press. A new edition is coming out soon. He's a leader in the anti-Iraq war movement here in America and a leader of the International Socialist Organization. Anthony Arnov, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me back.
Anthony, what's the book you wrote?
It's called Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal, which is a title I borrowed from Howard Zinn's book published in 1967 called Vietnam, The Logic of Withdrawal. The hardcover was published earlier this year by New Press, and it's coming out in an updated paperback edition in the American Empire Project series of Metropolitan Books.
That's great, because I read the book a couple of months ago, and Howard Zinn has the introduction, and then you wrote the book, and Howard also has the afterword. And what's amazing is you read what Howard said about Vietnam and what was said in the book he wrote about the logic of withdrawal for Vietnam. You could just change the name of the country, essentially.
Really, absolutely. And more we see the analogies with Vietnam becoming relevant to understanding Iraq. You're hearing about Iraqization, just like we had the idea that somehow Vietnamization would be a solution to the imminent defeat of the United States in Vietnam. You're talking now about this idea of controlling strategic cities like Baghdad, which is basically a retread of the strategic hamlet plan in Vietnam. You're hearing words like pacification, again, echoing the debate about Vietnam. And now the bringing in of a new defense secretary, just like in 1968, there was a shuffling of the personnel, the leadership in charge of the war. But, of course, the war continued long after 1968 when Clark Clifford was brought in to kind of repackage the subjugation of Vietnam. I think we're in an analogous moment to 1967, 1968, when Howard wrote that book. The Tet Offensive, that book, a series of indications that we had to get out of Vietnam, that the U.S. had been defeated, and yet the war continued, really, in a formal declaration of peace in 1973, but not a removal of all troops until 1975. And the war was continued through punishing economic sanctions on the country long after 1975. And also, of course, we should remember the war was expanded after 1968, the expansion of the war into Laos, into Cambodia. Millions of people lost their lives.
Anthony, let's fast forward to when they were forced to withdraw after ruining the country of Vietnam, finally forced to withdraw from Vietnam. Fast forward 20-some years, we had in the intervening period what people talked about as the Vietnam Syndrome, and that essentially meant that the United States' hands were tied in any kind of massive intervention like they'd done in Iraq. That all broke down, and they were able to, as we know, invade Iraq several years ago. That war, in my opinion, was an illegal war. I wanted to ask you what your thoughts are on that, and also Michael Ratner, what his thoughts are on that.
This war was started on utterly false pretexts, and we have to go back to that. We were told that this war was preempting an imminent threat to the United States, that Iraq posed a massive threat to the U.S. because of its weapons of mass destruction, its biological, its chemical, its nuclear weapons, that Iraq was connected with terrorist groups, particularly al-Qaeda. The administration repeatedly tried to link Iraq to the attacks of September 11th, 2001. Now, at the time, we knew that these charges were false. The anti-war movement, millions of people around the world, exposed all of the arguments that were being put forward by this government to justify this war, and arguments which we should remind ourselves were echoed uncritically on the front pages of papers like the Washington Post and the New York Times. And we knew at the time that these things were not credible, but certainly now there's no question that all of the justifications for this war have turned out to be false. And every day more evidence emerges that this government manipulated intelligence, manipulated public discourse in order to get a war that it really intended to pursue for other reasons, having nothing to do with the stated reasons, having to do with control of Iraq's energy resources, projection of power in the Middle East, the establishment of military bases in the region. and the legitimization of U.S. imperialism globally.
I mean, everybody, Anthony, I think is right. Everybody on the progressive side who understood U.S. hegemony and imperialism understood immediately, way before the war, what this war was about, that it was a hegemonic imperial war, which is why it was so easy, really, for us to see through this weapons of mass destruction stuff and the so-called relationship to al-Qaeda. Now, the thing they brought out in terms of legality was they basically tried to package a new legal reason for going to war. What Bush said, well, this is a war on terrorism, and terrorism strikes suddenly. It's not like they give you a warning, so we have to, you normally can go to war with somebody in self-defense if you're attacked, essentially. That's really the only way under the UN Charter that you can actually use force, other than if it's authorized by the United Nations within that context. So you really have a self-defense is the normal, is the normal way we lawyers think about this. And then all of a sudden you have Bush talking, as you mentioned, about preemptive or preventive war, whichever word you want to use, but preemptive war. And of course, when you have preemptive war, the people making the war can just make up the reasons for it, because who knows if it's true. One of the reasons they require self-defense is because they want someone actually bombing you or firing a gun at you before you go to a war. So the whole doctrine to me, actually, of preemptive war has been given for the administration, I would hope, a major setback. I mean, in terms of my thinking about law and war, that this war, if it stands for one thing, it's that that doctrine was really outrageous and wild, and look what it got us into. The other thing that brought to mind when you were talking is, of course, initially most of the Democrats went along with this in Congress. I mean, they did get a congressional authorization for this war, as bad as it was. It was a future one. It was based on all kinds of contingencies you can argue about. But they got one. They never got one for the United Nations, which they had to get. And so the Democrats went along with this, even though anybody with their eyes even half open would know. And then we come up now, and we had John Conyers, of course, do this huge 1,100-page thing about an inquiry into the origins of the Iraq War and having hearings on it if the Democrats took over and wanting to raise the impeachment question.
Well, I actually don't know what Conyers is saying about impeachment, but I know that Pelosi has taken impeachment off the table. And in effect, the Democrats have taken the question of withdrawal off the table. The Democrats defeated Mirtha. I think that was meant to be a signal to people who had aspirations that Mirtha would somehow be kind of spokesperson for a withdrawal position to try to marginalize that. And really what we're now seeing is the Democrats hoping that the Iraq study group is somehow going to provide what they're now calling a bipartisan solution.
Anthony Arif, tell us what the Iraq study group is, who makes it up, and what do you think they're trying to accomplish by using it?
Sure. Well, the Iraq study group is a classic example of an administration having a crisis, coming to need some kind of new strategy, and looking to, in effect, the wise men, group of outside advisors, people with government experience, but people very close to the politics of the government to repackage a problematic situation. And what they've done is they've turned to a group led by James Baker, who was the former Secretary of State under the first President Bush, under George W.'s father, the 41st President, Herbert Walker Bush, and by Lee Hamilton, a Democrat from the state of Indiana. They're chairing this commission. The commission also included Robert Gates, who's now been tapped to replace Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld since he was forced to step down in the wake of the midterm elections. And the group is looking at options for U.S. strategy moving forward in Iraq. There's a recognition that the U.S. has failed utterly and completely in Iraq, and there's an effort now to provide some kind of policy alternatives. But really, I think the mandate of the group is quite narrow. In terms of the strategies that have emerged from the discussion so far, it's very clear that withdrawal from Iraq is not on the table. They're looking to discuss options like sending more troops to Iraq, which is being pushed, of course, by John McCain, Senator McCain. They're also looking at the idea of partitioning the country, which is a proposal that Senator Biden, a Democrat, actually has been advocating. And they're also looking at various Vietnam-style strategic and tactical maneuvers. But really, I think what the commission is going to do is reaffirm the underlying principle of the occupation of Iraq and just provide some tactical advice on how to better achieve it.
What has been the human cost to the Iraqis and to the Americans in the war so far?
Oh, the cost is enormous. I mean, let's start with the Iraqis, because you so rarely hear about the impact of this occupation on the Iraqi people, a people who we allegedly were liberating through this occupation. The Lancet, which is one of the most respected medical journals in the world, recently did a study of population trends, mortality rates in Iraq, and they estimate now 655,000 excess deaths since the beginning of the U.S. occupation. There's been a massive spike in mortality, in violent death in Iraq as a result of the U.S. invasion. There's also clear evidence emerging every day of widespread abuse by U.S. troops. Just today, two cases are being reported on in the media that have come to trial. Massacre in Haditha, the massacre and rape in Mahmoudia, rape murder of a family, including a 14-year-old girl. And then to cover up the crime, the soldiers burned and the whole family, murdered the whole family.
You know, one of the cases we have in this case we brought in Germany, the Rumsfeld case against Rumsfeld, we represent a dozen or so Iraqis in that case. And one of the stories, I didn't talk to him, but my co-counsel talked to the guy in Iraq, and he said the following story, which is just, you know, it's reminiscent of it to me. After they let the guy go, finally, the guy is a young man, he's tortured for a week or so, and they realize he's completely innocent of anything. But what actually happened is his house had been marked. It was an area where there had been some part of the insurgency. His house had been marked by the administration or the military, the U.S. military, with an X or some kind of symbol that said, this is a bad house. And so they started by bombing the house. The U.S. military goes into the house, and they kill his 80-year-old father who's sitting there. Just shoot him. Just kill him right there. They take the guy into custody, and they, of course, torture the heck out of him, Abu Ghraib style, the whole thing. At the end of it, they say, well, you're innocent. And then he said, well, do I get an apology? Do I get anything? And they said, no, absolutely not. And they just let him out. And that, as you said, Anthony, it's thousands and thousands of stories like that. And I read a piece yesterday talking about terrorism in Iraq and how still, it's surprising, a majority still of the American people are very close to that, still believe that Saddam Hussein had something to do with terrorism and 9/11. I mean, remarkable that that's still the case. It was very high before the war, of course, at 63-70%. But it's still hovering in the 40s and 50s. And one of the things that American troops are trained to believe still to this day is that these are terrorists you're dealing with, and therefore you just got to kill them and abuse them and torture them. And so I think that's at least still one of the links.
Absolutely. One of the soldiers who took part in the Mahmoudia incident said in his defense, I hate Iraqis. That was his expression.
The Mahmoudia is the young girl who was raped, the 14-year-old. Recently, there was the one about the private security guy. Did you see that? Guy who works for a private security firm. Finally, he has a lawsuit against him because he was dismissed. And here's why he's dismissed. The last day he's there with a guy who is his supervisor is leaving Iraq the next day from this private security firm. And the guy says, you know, I haven't killed any Iraqis yet. And the guy goes and he just attacks a car filled with Iraqis and shoots a bunch of bullets into the car. They don't know what happened to the people, but right into the windshield, into like a dozen bullets into the car. And then the young guy who's the security guy who's making $500 a day for security running around there, he actually makes a complaint. And then he gets fired immediately from the job. And, of course, now he has a lawsuit. So it's coming out in this lawsuit. And the private security firm just lost a motion, so they're going to be able to set a trial date for this.
That's a very important part of the story. The largest contingent of troops is obviously U.S. troops. The second largest, with more troops than the British have in the so-called coalition, are private security, basically mercenaries.
Mercenaries, thugs, whatever word you want to use. It's almost like the mafia, but it's worse. These guys are just...
The mafia have some rules. You know, it's the kind of horror stories that we grew up on when we were kids, what our parents told us the Germans did to the Jews. And the Germans, of course, were able to do it because they dehumanized the Jews the same way the Americans dehumanized the Vietnamese by calling them communists, or now dehumanize the Iraqis by calling them terrorists. Anthony Arnov, if we can't rely on the Democratic majority in the Senate and the House now, what should we do next?
Well, first of all, I think we have to start from the fact that a majority of people in this country now think the war was a mistake. A majority want to see the troops come home. So we're starting from an organizing standpoint in a very strong position. The interesting thing about the midterm elections is not that it answers the problem of Iraq, but it shows people really want to see a change. Now, I don't think that the Democratic Party party leadership is going to push for a meaningful change in Iraq. I think it's going to take popular pressure in order to bring that about, and it's going to take pressure on the Democrats as well as on the Republicans. So we certainly can't go home and just hope that somehow Congress is going to cut off the funds for this war. The Democratic leadership has already said they will not use that tool, which is the most powerful tool they have in the Congress.
Yeah, that's what's amazing to me, because here you got, they can always say that, look, if we do an affirmative bill, the president can veto it. But if they just say we're not going to say yes to money in any, if they just cut, for example, the money for CIA secret detention facilities, it's over, guys. It's over. I mean,
not only that, they're talking, Senator Reid is talking about adding $75 billion to the military appropriations bill. This is on top of the hundreds of billions of dollars that have been added to the Pentagon budget for the so-called war on terror, for the occupation of Iraq, for the intervention in Afghanistan. And that's in addition, of course, to the indirect economic costs of this war. Joseph Stiglitz at Columbia University now estimates that the occupation of Iraq has cost more than $1.6 trillion. And this is happening in a time when, you know, we have not dealt with Katrina. That is a national tragedy. And community after community, city after city is facing budget cuts in healthcare, education, social spending, very important programs, including veterans programs, that are all being slashed. And yet the Democrats coming in after this election talking about giving more money to the military, we should be talking about a radical shift in our priorities.
That leads me to a follow-up question. If we all know the Republicans represent big oil, then who do the Democrats represent?
Well, it's a very interesting question. You know, Jack Murtha, who's a representative from Pennsylvania, has been held up for talking about redeploying troops from Iraq. I think it's important to look very carefully at that word redeployment, and also to look at who Jack Murtha is. Jack Murtha is a longstanding Democrat with very close ties to the military industry, to the military-industrial complex. In fact, he is the leading recipient of any party, Democrat, Republican, Independent, in the House or in the Senate of money from the space weapons lobby, by far the leading recipient. So he's connected to a wing of the military that sees that American imperialism would best be served by shifting to a greater emphasis on the projection of power from space and the use of air power. So in other words, less troops on the ground, less U.S. soldiers dying and making news with the mounting body count, which is now more than 2,850 U.S. soldiers, more than 20,000 wounded. But ultimately seeking the same aim, the projection of U.S. empire, the control of the energy resources of the Middle East, the domination of the region and of the world, the maintenance of U.S. hegemony, but a different tactic for how to do it. The Democrats are up to their knees in money from the military-industrial complex. Many of them, of course, also beholden to the same corporate interests as the Republicans. So if we want to bring about changes in these policies, it's going to take the kinds of grassroots movements that we built during the Vietnam War, demanding immediate withdrawal, demanding an immediate end to the war, and raising a whole series of other questions. One of the strengths of the movement against the war in Vietnam was that it began to involve the soldiers themselves, the soldiers who are fighting in Vietnam. We need to really encourage and give support to those groups like Iraq Veterans Against War, those soldiers who are a member of this group which is opposed to the occupation, speaking out against the war, demanding an immediate end to the occupation. And also, during the Vietnam War, there was a link between the civil rights movement in this country and the struggle of soldiers in Vietnam. People began to see these domestic issues, these issues of U.S. foreign policy as being intricately linked. You talked about the racism, the way in which Vietnamese were demonized. And just as the soldiers in the Vietnam War were taught to see the Vietnamese as gooks, as a way of dehumanizing them, so abuses could be carried out, so torture could be carried out, they're taught to see the Iraqis as all terrorists, as Hajis, and similar dehumanizing process, which is a process of serious indoctrination that anyone in the military goes through.
People suffer from that for a long time afterwards. Last night I was having dinner and I was seated next to a man who was a colonel in the Vietnam War. And after he'd had a few drinks towards the end of the night, you know, we were just talking and he said, "I'm going straight to hell. I am going to hell. Do you know how many people I have killed? I'm a murderer. In Vietnam, I can't even count the number of people I killed." he's just a broken man. He's very successful in his life, but it was heartbreaking to see that. And that's what, you know, in addition to the human rights abuses, what we are doing to our own troops is we're without a conscience if we continue to let it happen.
Absolutely. Last year, more U.S. soldiers committed suicide than in any year since 1993, right after the last major U.S. invasion of Iraq. Those figures underestimate the real number of suicides because there's been incidents of, in essence, suicide by cop, where people have engaged in incidents knowing that they would be shot by the police, and those haven't been counted as suicides. The rate of post-traumatic stress disorder of troops who have been sent to Iraq is quite high, higher than it was during the Vietnam War, according to some studies that I've seen. The number of injuries now, more than 20,000, injuries that are going to stick with most of those people for the rest of their life. Half of the wounded in this occupation have been so badly injured that they can't return to any kind of military service. So psychological, physical toll is enormous, but not just on those individuals, but on their families and on their communities. One of the things that I find people saying is they say, well, the problem is that not enough people have been affected by this war. I don't believe that. I think millions of people have been affected by this war. Communities around this country, particularly communities with where a large number of reservists have been called up for service. We're talking about people who thought maybe a couple of weekends a year they would go for some military exercises. Now, in some cases, they've been on 2, 3, 4 tours of duty. They've been to Afghanistan. They've been to Iraq. They've lost their jobs, separated from their families. And then, of course, the economic costs. And then, certainly appropriate for this show, the costs in terms of our civil liberties, that this war in Iraq has been a cover for a war on civil liberties in this country that affects all of us.
So, Anthony, we've talked about, I mean, a little bit about Vietnam and what the Democrats did there, which was nothing for a number of years, even after 68, really. It took years. And, of course, now everybody thought the Democrats are going to do something. They're going to maybe, some of them will really pull ask for withdrawal. And, of course, one of the key people in this is John Conyers, who up until this recent election had basically said, I'm going to hold a hearing on this thing. I'm going to look at the causes of the Iraq war. It's going to be an impeachment hearing. It came out with, you know, hundreds of pages of reports on it. And now, of course, I see that Conyers is pulling back. He now is not planning on this hearing to look into the causes of the war. And I think impeachment is completely off the table. What does it say about what we should be doing now, what reliance we should place on the Democrats?
I had very little hope that the Democrats would actually, coming in the midterm elections, pursue a policy of withdrawal. If you look at the Democratic Party's position on the war, there is no position on the war. In effect, their strategy was benefit from the fact that people oppose Bush, benefit from the fact that people oppose the Republican Party and the corruption of the party, benefit from the fact that people oppose the war in Iraq, but don't actually present a genuine opposition or policy alternative. In 2/3 of the congressional races that Democrats were running in that were close, the candidate was against any timetable for withdrawal, let alone immediate withdrawal, even some kind of timetable for withdrawal. Then you also have to look at the leadership of the party. They're already running in the 2008 election, and they don't want to take a stance.
You know, it's the same thing. It kills me. You know, and I went down there and I lobbied against the Military Commission Act, particularly around habeas, but around other torture provisions and others. And they all said to me, well, we're facing this immediate midterm election. We can't be seen as weak on terrorism. And I said to them, you know, you guys, you're going to be telling me this story forever. When we get to the presidential elections in 2008, you're going to say you still have to basically not go out against torture, not go out against military commissions because of the 2008 election. So in the end, you got to have people in the street. I mean, there's not an issue here.
I think there's a lot of things we can be doing right now. First of all, we should be supporting those soldiers who are speaking out, giving support to groups like Iraq Veterans Against War, supporting people who are involved in counter-recruitment efforts, groups like Campus Anti-War Network, the teacher and student groups that are confronting military recruiters, which helps undermine the basis of this war. If you can undermine the ability of the military to recruit people using the lies that they do to send people to Iraq, we can help hasten the day when U.S. troops have to leave that conflict. We need to be linking the war abroad with the war at home, finding connections between local community organizing efforts, the economic costs, the political consequences of this war in our communities with these broader questions about U.S. hegemony, U.S. control of energy in the Middle East. And we need to be in the streets to raise the costs of this war. If you look at history, that is what has brought an end to wars. That is what's brought about change, not relying on the Democrats, not relying on politicians, but raising the consequences of the war to the point where they have to rethink the calculus of power. The Iraqis have certainly made them rethink the calculus of power. We need to do that at home.
Anthony Arnov, author of Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal, thank you for joining us on Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show.
During the American war against the Vietnamese, who more than the American soldiers over in Vietnam knew the truth about the war? Their anti-war actions, bolstered by the peace movement here in the United States, was a big factor in getting out of Vietnam. We have today Jonathan Hutto, who's organizing in the Navy about getting out of Iraq.
Jonathan Hutto, welcome to Law and Disorder.
All right. Thank you, Dahlia, for having me on. And I want to thank everybody here for having me on as well. Just to give you a little background, this project, the Appeal for Redress, was something that was conceived a few months back. We had an opportunity to, bump into David Courtwright, who is the author of Soldiers in Revolt. We actually brought him to Norfolk June 2nd last summer. But I actually was introduced to his work while I was off the coast of Iraq in January of the early this year, January. I was on an aircraft carrier off the coast of Iraq. An old buddy of mine, who's a professor at Howard University, sent me the book Soldiers in Revolt, had a chance to read it, and was just totally blown by this entire history that I knew nothing of. I mean, you know, I'm a movement activist. I always have been, even though I'm in the military. So once I learned that history, I wanted to find out who Courtwright was, and we hooked up with Courtwright. We brought him here to Norfolk to meet with some active duty folks and also some civilian activists. And then we began to conceive of a campaign that could be legal in its creation, something that active duty people could engage, and at the same time, you know, still continue on with their daily lives. And we think we found something here with this Appeal for Redress.
How do you organize people, and what are you trying to accomplish?
Okay, the Appeal for Redress, an initiative based on DOD Directive 7050.6, that's the Military Whistleblower Protection Act. What that act says is that any and all military members can send a protected communication to a member of Congress on any issue without prior command approval, and that it cannot be any reprisals against that military member for having done so. That being said, that's what the appeal is based on legally. It's based on that. It's based on military members sending appeals to members of Congress. You go to our website at www.appealforredress.org. If you go to that website and you look at that form, it's pretty basic. You know, it asks you your name, your rank, if you've been in the Iraq theater, et cetera, and then you can click send that form in, and it goes to a supporting member of Congress. Our hope is that by the first of the year, you know, we'll have thousands of these appeals that we can then weigh in on the discussion and the ongoing debate about the future of the occupation of Iraq.
What is the ask? Is it to get out of Iraq? Is it just to have more say?
In the short term, okay, I see it as a two-pronged objective. The first, on the short term piece, what we want to do is win our policy leaders in Washington to the principle of withdrawal from Iraq. And when I say the principle of it, I mean once we win people, you know, our leaders to the principle of withdrawal from Iraq, then we can begin to discuss, well, what's the proper way to withdraw? You know, some people say, well, is that immediate withdrawal? Is that 6 months? Is that a year? Well, we're saying first we have to win our leadership to withdrawal, and then once you win your leadership to that, then you can begin to have that discussion. That's in the short term. In the long term, though, what we hope to see is an actual organization, an active duty service members organization that can be a lobbying advocacy arm on behalf of active duty members of the military, especially the enlisted members of the military who face many of the basic grievances, whether it's the higher question of war and imperialism or whether it's questions of just basic military life. You know, you still have military members that go through all types of just, you know, basic oppression within the military. You know, sexism is rampant. Homophobia is rampant. Racism is still a very major issue, and just issues around military justice. Unlike other countries where they have service member organizations or even unions for their military members, in the United States, culture from the day they step in.
Jonathan, I just wanted to remind our listeners who may have just tuned in that we're speaking with Jonathan Hutto, who is a Navy seaman based in Norfolk, Virginia. Getting back to the point you made that soldiers are still citizens, and they don't lose their rights just because they're in the armed forces. I remember that was put forward brilliantly during Vietnam when soldiers started to organize. And in fact, it was, in my opinion, one of the key things in getting the United States out of Vietnam was the amount of anti-war sentiment that existed over in Vietnam. The formulation then was that soldiers are still citizens. At that point, soldiers won the right to have literature. They won the right to demonstrate in the big peace demonstrations. That wasn't something they had when they started in Vietnam, and it was something they had at the end of Vietnam. A large part was due through the organization down there at Fort Jackson in the Fort Jackson 8 case. It's remarkable to me that you're doing the same thing using the Whistleblowers Act to put forward the rights of soldiers as citizens just the way they did during Vietnam.
You know, as we read in Soldiers in Revolt, by 1971, a little over 250,000 sailors, soldiers, and Marines had sent appeals to members of Congress back then on the question of the war. Now, of course, as you all know, the whole GI movement had a legal aspect and also had what we call, I'll just bluntly call it an untraditional, unorthodox aspect, meaning that there were legal channels. But also people did slowdowns, they did search and refuse, search and not search exactly. And then, of course, the highest form of resistance during that time, what they call fragging. Of course, our campaign hasn't advocated any of those methods because the way we look at it, those methods could potentially happen if our government does not heed the call of these military members and their families and the countless citizens of America that are calling for reform.
Jonathan, you've been to Iraq, yes?
I've been off the coast of Iraq. I haven't been on the ground in Iraq. No,
what leads you to believe we need to get out?
What led me to believe we need to get out? Well, in terms of what was presented to the American people and to the world, you know, the actual justification for going into Iraq, you know, once you look at that, I think right there, the source of it, you know, leads one to really question, you know, why are we there? But then beyond the source, you know, when you look at the cost, actual, you know, $350 billion-plus bill that's paying for an occupation. I mean, we're talking about a mass amount of resources. I mean, we're talking about, you know, building schools and infrastructure in Iraq, and there's certain places in America, New Orleans and the Gulf region, is symbolic of an area that needs schools and infrastructure. Billions of dollars in Iraq, lack of resources, you know, here at home. You're also looking at a military that's stretched beyond capacity, as documented by the New York Times October 1st editorial, America's Army on the Edge. You got two-thirds of your National Guard in Iraq. You got an army that missed its enlistment quota by 7,000 people last year. This year barely made it because they had to raise age limits and actually, you know, start recruiting people with certain criminal backgrounds. And then most disturbing of all, as documented by the Southern Poverty Law Center, we have, you know, white supremacists and Nazi groups actually openly advocating for their members to join the military. You know, this is the permanent damage that's been done to our military because of this war. The actual deaths, over 2,700 American lives, over 20,000 service members been disfigured, mangled, or hurt. And then, of course, Johns Hopkins University put that study out 2 weeks ago. Over 650,000 Iraqi people, men, women, and children, dead. That's not something that should sit well with any American citizen or any world citizen.
Jonathan, are your superiors aware of your organizing efforts? And if so, has there been any pressure to stop or any retaliation?
There hasn't been any form of retaliation or any pressure to stop. My superiors are aware. I've only been talked to in an official capacity by the public affairs officer on my ship, who continue to, you know, reiterate to me that as long as I'm off duty, off base, on my own time, and speaking in my personal capacity and not in an official capacity on behalf of the Navy, as long as I'm not in uniform, as long as I'm not using resources, and as long as I'm not saying anything, something denigrating about the president or, you know, something slanderous or something of that nature, then I'm definitely in the green light to move forward as we're moving forward now. Now, of course, I'm naive, and I don't believe that what we're doing is liked, you know, by the establishment. But at the same time, if that's what they say the rules are, that's what they say the law is, then we're going to test the law, the tradition of what activist movements, you know, before us have done. We're going to test the law to see if it works and to empower our constituents.
Well, nobody has more of a self-interest and more strategic power than you active duty GIs in the peace movement, Jonathan. And I think that because you have those democratic rights to speak out like you are, those are rights that were won in the past. If you don't use them, we're going to lose them. So you out there doing it is just a tremendous inspiration for everybody. What kind of response are you getting when you tell people the kind of things you've been telling our listeners?
Well, the kind of response I'm getting first, I mean, when we first started out, today is, I believe today is Wednesday, right? So we went public 9 days ago. We only had 65 active duty members who had signed on when we went public 9 days ago. Now we have right at a little over 1,200.
Wow.
And that was as of yesterday. And we're going through a verification process right now. And so we're getting about 20 or 30, you know, new signups every day.
Well, we're going to help you do that. We want you to repeat your appealforredress.org website for us, and we're going to link up lawanddisorder.org as our website. Repeat it for our listeners, will you?
Yeah, www.appealforredress.org. Okay, that's appealforredress, one word, .org. Go on there, and you'll see the sponsoring organizations, Military Families Speak Out, Veterans for Peace, Iraq Veterans Against the War. You'll also see our legal section for those military members that want to know what legally backs them up to do this, the Military Whistleblower Act with some other DOD directives. I got to thank those organizations for backing us up, because we wouldn't be able to do this type of work off of E3, E4 salary, you know. So I want to thank everybody for really supporting us. We definitely know that what we're doing is history-making, and hopefully it's going to bring together a permanence. I think that's one of the things, as David Courtwright, who wrote Soldiers in Revolt, was telling us, is that, you know, he wished that they were able to brought together active-duty service members organization at that time, you know, because a lot of the activities he felt were, you know, spontaneous and not necessarily coordinated. So we're trying to, you know, learn from that to coordinate a lot of the, you know, different activities that are going on. We got people signed up at bases all over the place. You know, want to continue to coordinate with these folks and get some activities going, some sir showings, you know, and just keep the movement alive.
For folks who are not an active duty military, what can they do to help?
Someone said it somewhere. I heard somebody say freedom isn't free, even though I'm not a people only giving money to fund the movement. But in this case, if you're a civilian and you want to help out, I mean, we definitely need some funds. So you can email us. I'll give you, in fact, go to the website, www.appealforredress.org, and there's an email down there that you'll see where you can email us your information and let us know that you want to donate to our move, and someone to get back with you expeditiously to let you know how to do that. Also, if you have some family members who are in the military, or you know other people that have family members that are in the military, they don't have to be in Iraq. They can be anywhere in the world. Get in contact with them. Send them a message. Get them an email. Send them a phone call. Let them know what we're doing and tell them to plug into this network.
Jonathan Hutto, active duty Navy seaman. I want to tell you, first of all, that here at Law and Disorder, I'm going to send you $100 to support your organization, appealforredress.org. We just think what you're doing is terrific. Thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, everybody.
Okay, take it easy.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Our next guest is Jonathan Heifetz. Jonathan Heifetz is a lawyer at the Brennan Center, who I have worked with in the past on Guantanamo cases. He is currently working on a case of a U.S. citizen who is being held by the United States. The person's name is Mohammed Mounaf. Mohammed Mounaf has been convicted of a death penalty crime in Iraq by the Iraqis. He's in U.S. custody, and Jonathan and other lawyers are making a last-ditch appeal to the Supreme Court to prohibit the U.S. from turning Mohammed over to the Iraqis, where it's very likely he will be executed. It was an extraordinary case in which there was really no evidence against Mohammed for the crime. The trial was interrupted, as Jonathan will explain. U.S. came in, apparently, and went into the back room with the judge and somehow came out with a conviction.
Welcome, Jonathan, to Law and Disorder.
Hi, Dahlia.
It's good to have you here, but unfortunately, the case sounds really grim. Tell us what happened to your client.
Our client, Mohammed Mounaf, an American citizen, has been in U.S. custody in Iraq for more than 16 months. The U.S. are holding him at Camp Cropper at the Baghdad airport. In October last month, he was convicted and sentenced to death by an Iraqi criminal court accused of kidnapping when he was actually a victim of the kidnapping. He was kidnapped with a group of Romanian journalists and held for 2 months. They were all released.
Tell us what he was doing in Iraq and how he came to be there.
Mr. Mounaf was an American citizen, was living in Romania with his wife and three children. In May of 2005, he traveled to Iraq with three Romanian journalists who were investigating the situation in Iraq and reporting on it for their media organizations. He accompanied them as a guide and translator. He was born in Iraq and spoke the language, was familiar with the terrain, so he was appropriate for that role. The journalists and Mr. Mounaf were kidnapped by an insurgent group shortly after arrival, and they were held for approximately 2 months. They were then released after 2 months in captivity. The journalists went free. Mr. Mounaf was taken into custody by American forces in Iraq and held at Camp Cropper, where he remains today. So he's been in U.S. custody for 16 months.
Wait, he was kidnapped, and upon his release, the U.S. government held him on what basis?
Well, they allege that he was a participant or planner of the kidnapping and not a victim. So that's the allegation, that he set up the kidnapping and he wasn't a victim. So that's the allegation against him. There were there were no charges. He was just held. He was denied access to American lawyers. He was also subjected to mistreatment. He was threatened with abuse. His threats were made against his family. If he didn't cooperate with them, they tried to force him to make statements to incriminate himself. While he was in custody, he was subsequently charged in an Iraqi criminal court proceeding with being a participant in the kidnapping. And on October 12th, he was sentenced to death.
Tell us about the proceeding.
Well, the proceeding was fundamentally unfair. No witnesses were not presented. There was evidence. The evidence against him was evidence, statements that he supposedly made while he was tortured. They were forced out of him again by these threats of violence and this incommunicado detention without access to counsel. At the trial, the American military officials appeared to press the case. Because Romanian nationals were the victims, Romania had to to support the prosecution for it to go forward. No Romanian official appeared. Instead, a U.S. military official appeared, claiming to be acting on behalf of the Romanian government, pressing for Mr. Mounaf's prosecution. The Romanian government last week announced that it never authorized the U.S. to represent Romania at the trial and press for Mr. Mounaf's prosecution. So in a sense, his conviction was obtained under what appears to be totally false pretenses.
My understanding, or what I heard back in the United States about this case, is that the prosecution was going on with the Iraqi judge, and the Iraqi judge indicated that there was not sufficient evidence to convict this man of kidnapping. It appeared that he was going to set this man free when two American military personnel appeared in the courtroom and asked to speak with the judge. They went to a back room, spoke with the judge, without the defense attorney or the defendant present. And when the judge came back, this man was then convicted and sentenced to death without any explanation.
Well, we filed a habeas corpus petition on his behalf, challenging his detention. He's an American citizen held by the U.S. Throughout this whole period of time, he's been in U.S. custody. So the U.S. has arrested him.
So the issue now is about turning him over to the Iraqis to be executed, right?
That's correct. That's the issue now.
And what you're trying to prevent with a habeas is to try and prevent him from being turned over for his execution.
Exactly. He was illegally arrested, and to try to prevent him from being turned over for his execution based on a trial that, as Dali explained, violated basic due process rights. And the government's response, and we get to really the crux of the legal issue, is that even though Americans have been holding him and Americans are going to hand him over to face execution, he does not have a right to go to court to get review because the America is acting as part of a multinational force. So they claim that America is wearing this UN badge. And so because of that, when they hold an American citizen, bring an American citizen for trial, and hand an American citizen over for death, they don't have to answer to a federal court. And this goes against a century of precedent that says when the U.S. holds an American citizen, they have to answer for his detention or for his transfer in a federal court.
Right. They're just saying we're doing a favor and holding him for somebody else, essentially.
Yeah. Something really stinks about this case, but beyond the fact that there was no evidence other than his forced confession obtained under torture, the fact that U.S. military personnel appeared in court, had a backdoor proceeding with the judge, and the fact that Romanian officials have refused to prosecute this man and have not accused him of anything. Why is this man receiving the death sentence for allegedly participating in a kidnapping?
The death sentence also seems to be very, very extreme. Certainly the allegations of kidnapping are significant. No one was injured. And as Dali had mentioned a moment ago, the prosecution was actually supposed to be dropped because Romania did not want to press the charges. That all changed when the U.S., claiming to be acting on Romania's behalf, pushed for the prosecution and pushed for the death penalty. Romania has since denounced that or denied that through its justice minister and has actually told Attorney General Gonzalez that the Munaf should not be transferred to Iraqi custody.
Many Americans think people in the Muslim world are death penalty lovers. And really, I think America is much more enamored with the death penalty than the countries that we think.
Well, the district court denied his habeas petition and disagreed with another district court judge who, in another case that we are involved in, who said the U.S. can't transfer a U.S. citizen over to Iraqi custody without judicial review. The district court in Mr. Munaf's case dismissed his case, said there's no jurisdiction because the U.S. is acting as part of a multinational force, even though it's holding him and it's pulling all the strings in his case. We went to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. We've appealed that decision, but more importantly, have filed an emergency motion to prevent his transfer in order for the court to hear his case before Mr. Munaf is handed over and put to death, which could happen very shortly. The Court of Appeals denied that motion in a 2-1 decision, but gave Mr. Munaf a week to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Oh, my gosh.
Jonathan Hafetz, thank you for joining us on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Jonathan Hafetz, a lawyer from the Brennan Center, the lawyer for Mohammed Munaf. After we recorded the show with Jonathan about the status of Mohammed Munaf, whose case was pending in the Supreme Court, we heard the terrible news, really terrible news, that the Supreme Court had turned down his appeal. And as far as I know now, the United States is free to turn Mohammed Munaf over to the Iraqis, where he very well may be executed. It's a really sad, sad case, another consequence of this country's unlawful, illegal, immoral war against Iraq.
Law and Disorder was produced by Jeff Brady. We'd like to thank our affiliates and our many listeners.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.